From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, a fateful decision that led to the 1979 Iran hostage crisis. The American airstrike that killed Iranian military commander Qasem Soleimani in Baghdad this month brought the two countries closer to war than at any time since the Iranian Revolution in 1979.
We begin tonight with the U.S. and Iran on the brink, and the president alerting Congress tonight the U.S. will respond with force if Iran retaliates for the drone strike. The Trump administration tonight insists Americans are safer with Soleimani dead, but security remains on alert both at home and abroad.
Days before the assassination, Iranian-backed militias led an assault on the U.S. embassy in Baghdad that brought to mind the Iranian hostage crisis of 1979.
Violent anti-American protesters are attacking the U.S. embassy in Baghdad this morning. Guards reportedly have responded with tear gas and stun grenades.
This week, we look back at the decision U.S. President Jimmy Carter made to allow the deposed Shah of Iran into the United States for medical treatment in October 1979. That decision prompted Iranian protesters to take over the U.S. embassy in Tehran.
Several hundred young people, mainly students at Tehran University, have taken over the embassy. We are not occupiers, they said. We have thrown out the occupiers. But instead of chasing all the Americans out of the compound, the Iranians imprisoned them in a building somewhere on these grounds. They have been hostages ever since.
They would hold hostage 52 Americans for nearly 15 months. The ordeal forever tarred the relationship between the two countries. David Kirkpatrick, a reporter for the New York Times, examined documents related to that decision by Carter for a recent story. He concluded that David Rockefeller, the chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank at the time, played a key role in the drama. Kirkpatrick is also author of Into the Hands of Soldiers, Freedom and Chaos in Egypt and the Middle East. Kirkpatrick is our guest this week on First Person. Thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
We are going to focus on a piece that you wrote about the Shah of Iran being welcomed into the United States for medical care. But before we talk about how that happened, the Shah of Iran was deposed in early 1979. Can you just tell us a little bit about his reign and the circumstances that brought it to an end?
Sure. So by the beginning of 1979, by January 1979, Tehran was basically boiling over. You know, the Shah had been previously more or less forced out of power in 1953, famously, by an elected prime minister and fled the country. He was then restored in a military coup with American backing. Resentment over that had never gone away. And by late 1978 and early 1979, there were riots and protests in the streets of Tehran. There was a coalition of leftists, liberals, and religious conservatives all out in force, determined to drive him from power. And the Shah himself was more or less dithering. And so by January of 1979, it became clear that his rule was no longer tenable. One thing that we often forget now is that in those early months of 79, when it was clear the Shah had to go, it was not at all clear what was going to replace him and whether the new government would actually be hostile to the U.S. or not. The Carter administration broadly hoped that it might be able to preserve the American-Iranian alliance, which at that time was really the bedrock of American policy in the Persian Gulf and the region. I mean, people at that time referred to the Shah routinely as the American-backed policeman of the Gulf. So all of this was up in the air. And at first, Carter tried to get the Shah to leave voluntarily by offering him refuge in the United States.
And when did he offer that refuge? In January of 1979?
Yes, I believe it was in around January, and even in February of 1979, the Shah was still pretty explicitly welcomed to come to the U.S. But having fled the turmoil in Iran, the Shah was eyeing a return, so he didn't want to go too far. You know, to go to the U.S. looks like you're giving up forever. He tried to hang around the region. He went to Cairo. He went to Morocco. He wanted to be close by in case events moved in his favor.
And in the meantime, who is he closest to within the administration or in the American government?
It's not entirely clear. I mean, he was very close to the American ambassador. I can't think of who his closest contact was within the administration. But he was very, very close to David Rockefeller, who was the chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank, which had become the main banker for the Shah's government.
Tell me a little bit more about the Shah on the road with his family, his children, his wife. Where do they go, and what do those months look like?
Yeah, it was quite an odyssey. Because as you mentioned, it's a pretty large entourage. You know, he's got all his security people, his retainers traveling with him from the moment he left Tehran is a Republican political operative who has been sent to him by the Rockefeller family, by the way. But he's got this huge operation, this huge household on the road. First, they go to Cairo, where he's good friends with President Sadat. Then he goes to Morocco, but he's told he's got to leave Morocco because there's an Arab summit coming in and not all the Arab governments want to be hanging around with the Shah. And it's around that time in March that President Carter changes his mind about welcoming the Shah. And they try to send a message to him that he's got to find another place to go. They've realized that accepting the Shah into the U.S. will look like the U.S. is conspiring against the new Iranian government still taking shape and anger all those Iranians in the streets. They don't want to do that, so the Shah is no longer welcome. So that's when David Rockefeller and his friend Henry Kissinger get into the act, and they begin scrambling with a team within the Chase Manhattan Bank to try to find a temporary haven for the Shah while they persuade Carter to let him in. And the places they send him include first the Bahamas and then later Mexico, where they've set him up with his whole household. His time in the Bahamas was especially wasteful. I think the a resort that the government of the Bahamas had set up for him really gouged the heck out of the Shah, and that became tiresome for the Shah and his entourage.
And at this point, where are we in the Iranian revolution? Is it becoming clearer what that's going to look like, what that new government is going to be?
Well, it's become clear by March that there's going to be a new government. But what's important to remember is it was by no means clear at that time that the Ayatollah Khomeini, is going to be in charge, or even that it's going to be a religious conservative or theocratic government. There were people in Washington who were worried the outcome might be left-leaning. There were people on the ground who were hoping the outcome might be liberal. So all of this was still very much up in the air throughout most of 1979, heading up to the eventful period of October and November.
So you've mentioned several times David Rockefeller. Before you tell me about his role, tell me about how you learned about his role.
You know, it's interesting. At the time, there was some grumbling on the part of the Carter administration about David Rockefeller's role, but it really reached my attention because somebody I've known for a while in a very different context, a guy named Charles Francis, who gained national attention as a good friend of President George W. Bush. Mr. Charles Francis had, as a young man, worked in the public relations department of the Chase Manhattan Bank. And he attended David Rockefeller's funeral a year or so ago. Rockefeller died at the age of 101. And at the funeral, Henry Kissinger spoke. And Kissinger spoke at length about Rockefeller's relations with the Shah. And that caused Charles Francis to dig around a little bit. And it came to his attention, and he brought to my attention, the fact that a trove of papers regarding Rockefeller's relationship with the Shah had been sealed all these years until Rockefeller's death, papers from inside the Chase Manhattan Bank, and had just recently become open. So I went to the Yale University archive to get access to those papers, and they were, I thought, really quite a revelation.
These papers reveal to you something called Project Eagle. What is Project Eagle?
So Project Eagle was the code name that David Rockefeller and a handful of his top aides inside the Chase Manhattan Bank, the code name that they put together for their efforts on behalf of the Shah. They called the Shah Eagle, and they very much admired him. And it was their efforts to find a place for him in the U.S., to find schools for his kids, to find an appropriate estate, and then their efforts to lobby the Carter administration to let him in when the Carter administration didn't want to do that, and to arrange transportation for him, to arrange visas for himself and all of his entourage, and really ultimately to continue advocating on his behalf even after he had come for medical treatment and then left again. It was their umbrella for their whole Shah advocacy campaign. And really, they became almost kind of a de facto American embassy, if you will, for the Shah.
What was Rockefeller's motivation for that?
You know, he has said that his motivation was public-spirited, that here was a foreign leader who had been a good friend of the U.S., and it was bad faith of the U.S. not to look out for him in his time of need, that it was going to demoralize other rulers around the world who had been American allies. When you read the papers, it's very clear that he's getting frequent updates on the financial stakes for the Chase Manhattan Bank from the events in Iran, and that the Chase Manhattan Bank had a great deal to lose if the Shah left power. It was the main financial conduit for the Iranian state oil company. It was the main lender to the Iranian government when it was running big state-sponsored projects. And it was the main holder of a lot of that government's foreign deposits. So Iran had to be one of the bank's biggest clients.
So you have Rockefeller advocating for Chase Manhattan Bank and for the Shah. But there's a dilemma in Washington as well. And there are those who are for and those who are against allowing the Shah in. Who's for and who's against and why?
Well, the critical person here is President Carter. And President Carter was against letting the Shah in because that appeared to him to foreclose the possibility of productive relations with the new Iranian government still to form. Against that, the main argument, the argument in favor of bringing in the Shah, was basically, look, this is our guy. Like Somoza in Nicaragua was our guy. We have to look out for our friends around the world. Remember, this is in the context of the Cold War, and there were, you know, a pretty decent number of unsavory strongmen around the world that the U.S. numbered as its allies in the fight against communism. You don't want to spook all those people by turning your back on the Shah in his time of need.
The Carter administration, President Carter himself, to this day, is seen primarily as a humanitarian. And in fact, it became a bit of a knock on him at the time. But his man on the ground advocated for non-humanitarian actions against the demonstrators. What did he advocate for?
You know, that's interesting. So in the final weeks of the Shah's rule in Tehran, President Carter sent over a personal envoy, General Heiser. And General Heiser's mission has been widely misunderstood. I mean, a lot of people in Iran have said, oh, he was sent over to plot a coup. He was sent over to get rid of the Shah. In these Rockefeller papers, in these Project Eagle papers, there's a lot about General Heiser because he went to the Rockefeller team and he said, Mr. Rockefeller, you're very close to the Shah. You're very close to the Shah's family. I need you to help me correct the record. I got to get these letters to the Shah's family, and I want to tell you the real story. I went over there to support the Shah. My message to the Iranian generals, and this was on what he believed was his instructions from President Carter, his message to the Iranian generals was, kill as many people as you need to. Kill as many protesters as you have to. As he put it in his conversation with the Rockefeller team, he said, he told the generals, if shooting over their heads doesn't work, move to focusing on their chests. And the goal was not a military coup. The goal was for the military to take power, to control the utilities, to control the media, to control the streets, to control everything in order to keep the Shah in power. So certainly there's evidence that President Carter was not sort of pussyfooting around humanitarian concerns. He was trying to do what he could in perhaps an ill-informed way to get the Iranian military to really stiffen themselves up and repress the protests in order to keep the Shah in power.
So there's a debate about allowing the Shah in well before his medical crisis comes to pass. But what happens to him? He actually, his health begins to deteriorate. What's wrong?
So by the time the medical emergency comes to light, a number of people in the administration, including National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, had come around because of the advocacy of Rockefeller and especially Kissinger, had come around to be pretty sympathetic to the idea of bringing in the Shah. It turns out that the Shah had been hiding a diagnosis of cancer for some time. The CIA, American intelligence, American diplomats, nobody knew. The Shah is in Mexico, and he begins to complain of various medical symptoms, and nobody knows what that is, and he's not forthcoming about it. So David Rockefeller's team sends down one of their personal physicians, somebody who from New York, whose expertise is actually contagious diseases, and that person goes down to take a look-see, as they put it, and eventually comes to the realization that the Shah has indeed been hiding cancer all of this time. And that's the critical moment. David Rockefeller, being David Rockefeller, is able through his staff to get that doctor on the phone with top officials in the State Department. According to the doctor, he later said his conclusion was, well, the Shah needs treatment. It could happen in Mexico. It should happen soon. It doesn't have to happen right away, but clearly he's very sick. What the State Department officials thought they heard from that doctor and what they conveyed to the president was the Shah is on death's door and the only place he can get the medical attention he needs is in New York. And that was the moment when President Carter decided that he would allow the Shah in for strictly humanitarian reasons and very much reluctantly, very much with many misgivings about the safety of the American personnel in Tehran.
So obviously Americans remember the hostage crisis, which went on for well more than a year, and the seizing of the American embassy. But it wasn't actually the first seizure of the embassy. Tell us about the first seizure of the embassy.
Well, early in 1979, in February, and I think this is one of the events that caused President Carter to change his mind about letting in the Shah, there was a group of Iranian demonstrators who actually stormed the American embassy in Tehran and temporarily shut it down. Now, on that occasion, the Iranian security forces responded relatively quickly under the interim government and restored the embassy, you know, kicked out the protesters and kept everybody safe. It was back open again in a relatively short period. But from that moment on, everybody, all the way up to President Carter himself, was very much aware that the American personnel in Tehran were at risk. You know, there were later reports that as President Carter ultimately allowed in the Shah, he even said at the time, you know, don't blame me when our people in Tehran are taken hostage.
So did the United States State Department, did they pull back non-essential personnel after that, or did they keep people in Tehran?
They kept people in Tehran. The embassy was open and functioning after that first seizure, in part because the response from the interim government had been reassuring. You know, the protesters were driven away after a short time, and nobody was hurt.
So President Carter himself says, if we let the Shah in, we run a risk of our personnel on the ground in Tehran being targeted as a result.
According to subsequent reports by some of his aides, yeah, even as he was weighing the Shah's entry, he was mindful that the American personnel at the embassy in Tehran could be at risk.
So now we understand American officials have come to know that the Shah is quite sick. It's not an infectious disease. It's cancer. He needs to be seen by a specialist. The specialist who goes down to Mexico where the Shah is sitting with his family at this point after meandering from Cairo to Morocco to the Bahamas to Mexico says he actually could be treated in Mexico, but that's not what American officials hear. American officials hear, nope, the only place he can be is New York City, where there's the top cancer experts in the world. And so the Shah arrives in Florida. Tell us about the scene that you describe in this story of who's on board and what that looks like, that arrival.
What was so striking to me when I got to read these papers was the inside account from the debriefing the next morning at the Chase Manhattan Bank. So what happened is the Shah arrives at the airport on a Gulfstream 2 jet arranged by the Chase Manhattan Bank. He's got his entourage. He's got a number of Iranian generals. He's got his wife. He's got three big, rambunctious, and smelly dogs on the plane with him. And as they're pulling into the airport, there's nobody from the American government there to receive them. The only one there who's ready to receive them is actually an executive of the Chase Manhattan Bank who's been sent down by David Rockefeller. And that executive is the one who tells the local law enforcement officials, the local custom officials, the local immigration officials that they've got a VIP on their hands. The Shah of Iran is about to land. So that was a complete surprise to everybody on the ground. And then that executive takes charge, starts barking orders to the local officials, makes sure that nobody comes off the plane, loads himself onto the plane, and they take off again for New York, where a larger Chase Manhattan Bank operation is ready to meet the Shah at LaGuardia Airport and squire him off into a hospital. They try to stop briefly at his sister's mansion in Beekman Place, but they see somebody waiting outside. They might be a photographer, so they scotch that, and they get him into the New York hospital.
When does the media become aware that he's there?
I think almost immediately. I think by the next day, the media becomes aware and there start being protests outside the hospital organized by Iranians in New York.
And what's the response in Tehran when it becomes clear that the Shah is in New York?
Irate, furious. that's when things really kicked off in Iran. In retrospect, it's the hostage crisis that becomes the moment when the religious conservatives, when Ayatollah Khomeini is able to finally seize power and consolidate his control over the nascent revolution. A group of Iranian students loyal to the Ayatollah stormed the embassy about a week later. And as they did so, they said very explicitly that they were doing this in retaliation for the admission of the Shah into Washington. Because, of course, if you're Iranian, if you remember 1953, if you remember the American-backed coup that restored the Shah to power, the fact that the Shah has taken refuge in the United States is going to have special resonance for you. So that confrontation becomes a sort of polarizing event that allows the Ayatollah and the religious conservatives to take power and consolidate their hold on the revolution inside Tehran, and at the same time sets in motion this whole four-decade realignment of the Gulf, where the United States turns to the other side of the Persian Gulf, to the Arab countries in Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, to be their new favorite allies. And the contest for power between Iran and the United States becomes the driving force in so much around the region.
I want us to get to that massive switch in where the American alliances in the Middle East are. But before we do that, describe this period, the 444-day hostage crisis in the United States, and the crisis that it becomes for Carter.
You know, again, looking back at that period in hindsight is fascinating. You know, during the first part of the hostage crisis, it didn't really hurt Carter politically. You know, that was the period when he pioneered the Rose Garden strategy. He was looking very presidential. There was a sort of rally around the flag, rally around the president effect in the context of this crisis. It's only as it started to drag on, and especially after a disastrous rescue attempt. You know, Carter, at what point during the hostage crisis, authorized and then aborted a military raid to try to rescue the hostages by force. That ended in a helicopter crash in the desert that killed a number of American service members. That was a real humiliation. And in the light of that, the whole hostage crisis looked more and more like a humiliation for the United States. And that it became clearly more than the Carter presidency could recover from. Now, this was 1979, so we're heading into the 1980 election. The Reagan campaign was very mindful that if the hostages were released, all of this could turn around overnight, that Carter could look like a hero, and instead of an endangered lame duck, he could be once again riding high. So the Reagan campaign, too, was very mindful that Carter's future was bound up with the hostages.
It was in Reagan's best interest for the hostages to be released, not under Carter.
Correct. And that gets into a very sort of morally and ethically complicated question. You know, if you are the Reagan campaign, you find yourself in the awkward position of identifying your best interest with something that is not the best interest of the United States of America. You can't possibly say, boy, I hope they don't release the hostages. And what the Reagan campaign did is invent the term October surprise. So the Reagan campaign very deliberately started collecting information and spreading rumors about the possibility that the Carter administration might arrange the release of the hostages before the election deliberately for political reasons, right? They started floating rumors that suggested there was going to be some kind of a payoff, some kind of a deal, some kind of a trade to get the hostages out for Carter's benefit, so that the Reagan campaign were effectively preemptively trying to discredit a hostage release, to sort of arm themselves against it.
Who in the campaign was doing that disinformation?
So Richard Allen, who was a foreign policy advisor to the campaign, has acknowledged that he was more or less the architect and implementer of the October surprise or anti-October surprise strategy. He's talked publicly, including to me, about the campaign's efforts to try to gather that information and spread it around to try to preempt or forestall the political damage from a hostage release. It's also clear from the Rockefeller papers that William Casey, who was the Reagan campaign manager and later the CIA director, was part of that effort. And in fact, as the hostage crisis goes on, there's some notes that show that the Rockefeller team was involved in gathering information through their own sources around the world, through the Chase Manhattan Bank, and then sharing that information with the Reagan campaign as part of the Reagan campaign's efforts to get ahead of a possible hostage release.
The Shah comes to the United States for medical care, but he doesn't stay here, does he?
No, the Carter administration, bucking advocacy from the Rockefeller team, makes it clear that the Shah can't stick around. And he eventually finds his way back to, first to Panama and then to Cairo, where he dies in 1980.
But the legacy of his time in the United States seems to linger on.
It certainly does.
How do you think things might have been different if Carter had simply not decided to allow the Shah to enter the United States?
Well, isn't that a fascinating question? I think we have to say, working from the inside outward, Carter might well have gone on to win a second term. The Reagan Revolution wouldn't have happened. And it's possible that the Ayatollah and the theocratic regime in Tehran may never have consolidated their power. You know, many people will say, look, in retrospect, those were the most powerful forces maneuvering on the ground. They used the hostage crisis, but they would have taken power anyway. They would have found something else to be the precipitating event. The fact is, it was the hostage crisis that was the pivotal moment. And had there been no hostage crisis, we don't really know how events inside Tehran would have unfolded.
So you feel that the hostage crisis was very much precipitated by, even took place because of, the decision by the Carter administration, under much pressure, to allow the Shah in for cancer care?
Well, yeah, because that's what the Iranian students said when they were seizing the embassy. So you might say, well, in retrospect, we see a lot of other factors there, and that's true. But you can't discount the fact that the people who took the hostages said at the time they were taking the hostages because the Shah had been led into the United States. I mean, that's clearly a major factor.
Obviously, this is all now 40 years ago, and I wonder how large the hostage crisis looms in the minds of Americans and Iranians these days. How big of a factor do you think the hostage crisis remains in terms of the relationship between these two countries?
I think at this point, it's a bigger factor in the U.S. You know, I think in the popular discourse in Iran, they're still at 1953. They're still remembering the American role in that coup. They're still talking about Kermit Roosevelt, the CIA operative who took credit for it later. But for the United States, that experience, the 444-day ordeal of the hostage crisis, the humiliation of the helicopter crash out in the desert, the yellow ribbons that we all wore, the nightly newscast that we all remember, that is still very resonant. And we see it when President Trump is talking about attacking 52 different sites inside of Iran as a form of retaliation. And the number 52, he links to the number of hostages.
You mentioned that the decision of the Carter administration to allow the Shah into the United States, the hostage crisis itself, the Iranian Revolution taking place as it did, and the realignment of U.S. relationships in the region. Talk to me a little bit about that realignment. What takes place? Where is that shift? And how does the United States go to being at odds for the last almost half century?
Well, you have to consider it one of the seismic events in the shaping of the modern Middle East. You know, the U.S. had invested very, very deeply and almost exclusively in a military-to-military partnership with Iran. Remember, in 1979, the American military partnership with Egypt had not yet taken place. The Camp David Accords had not yet taken place. So obviously, Israel was a very close ally. But Iran, believe it or not, was at that time considered kind of a soft ally for Israel in a sort of enemy of my enemy is my friend logic. If Israel was squaring off against the Arab countries, then Iran, a Persian country with its own Arab issues, was a natural partner for Israel. And that was the world at the start of 1979. And since that time, all of that has been fundamentally reversed. The U.S., in its efforts to counter Iran and protect the flow of oil out of the Persian Gulf, has become closer and closer and closer to Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and the other Arab Gulf monarchies on the other side of that body of water. And Iran, instead of being a friend to Israel and a friend to the United States, has become its principal enemy in the region. So the whole structure and pattern of the American alliances in the region and the politics of the region in 1978 has been completely reversed. And the two events of 1979, the hostage crisis and the Camp David Accords, really are at the center of that.
So obviously we're talking about Trump a great deal because of the strike on Qasem Soleimani. But I'm curious about how the Obama administration's Iran nuclear deal fits into this history of animus and difficulty between Iran and the United States.
You know, in many ways, I think that nuclear accord was an attempt to kind of undo the legacy of the hostage crisis. I mean, people off the record, people around the Obama administration will often say, look, if we just woke up today and we looked at the Persian Gulf, maybe our most natural ally might be Iran if it hadn't been for the hostage crisis and that legacy and all that animosity. It doesn't make sense for us to be in such an existential conflict with Iran at the cost of all of our other policies around the region. And the nuclear accord was, in a way, an attempt to break out of that dynamic, to at least take the nuclear threat, the potential nuclear threat, off the table, but also to offer the government in Tehran some incentives to try to become less of a pariah, to try to become more integrated into the international community. I think what we're seeing now is, in a way, not just a reversion to norms, but almost a reversion to 1979. I mean, what we're seeing now in the new Trump administration conflict with Iran since the killing of Qasem Soleimani is a level of animosity on both sides, which feels like it's November 1979, right after the hostages were taken.
One of the things that struck me about the Trump decision, the Trump administration decision to renege on the Iranian nuclear deal, was the anxiety over humiliation. I'm curious about whether or not this is as much about humiliation and about honor in some respects as it is about actual military tactics.
On which side? The Iranian side or the United States side?
I guess both. I mean, I think for sure the Iranian side. I mean, there was a great deal of talk about the delicacy with which the Iran nuclear deal negotiations took place and how there was a lot of talk about making sure that people felt respected. You know, you mentioned the helicopter downing in 1970, the failed rescue attempt. And one of the things that happened there was, of course, that the bodies of those downed American operatives were not treated honorably. And I'm curious about that, the ways in which countries dishonor each other and how that plays a role in escalation.
Well, I think what you're really talking about is the legacy of history on both sides. These memories of past slights are hard to walk away from. It's difficult to simply shake hands and forgive and forget after you have memories seared in the public consciousness of either country. The 1953 coup in the case of Iran, or the hostage crisis and those bodies paraded through the streets in the case of the United States.
So, I mean, obviously, there's a sort of tangled legacy here that we're talking about. One is the very specific legacy of the Iran-American relationship and the way in which allowing the Shah into the United States, the rise of the Iranian Revolution, the radical rupture between two countries that had been allies. And then the other is around American support for authoritarians and for dictators. And I'm curious about how this legacy and the legacy of our actions on the ground on behalf of the Shah have had repercussions to this day.
You know, it came up a great deal when I was the Cairo bureau chief for the New York Times and covering the Arab Spring. American policymakers were again and again and again preoccupied with the American experience of the revolution in Tehran in 1979. Nobody wants to be President Carter. Nobody wants to be accused of allowing a friendly strongman, a friendly authoritarian to fall and watching an unfriendly revolutionary power take hold. And I think if people look back and understood that, in fact, Carter had done his best in a way to get the Iranian military to prop up the Shah, that almost revises the way that legacy is understood. And clearly, that legacy continues to cast a major shadow over American policymaking as the American government looks out towards its authoritarian allies around the world.
David, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
That was David Kirkpatrick. He's a reporter for the New York Times and the author of Into the Hands of Soldiers, Freedom and Chaos in Egypt and the Middle East. First Person is produced by me, Sarah Wildman, along with Dan Haverty. Our editor is Rob Sachs, and our executive editor for news and podcasts is Dan Efron. If you like this episode, please subscribe. Then come back next week. We'll have a new episode.